stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I'm continuing to air interviews I did with directors who are directing productions for the Oslo Repertory Theatre 2012 season. Today's interview is with Peter Amster, who, as an avid Noel Coward fan, is delighted to be given the opportunity to direct Fallen Angels, probably the second play that Coward wrote, and which has been unavailable for production for many years. So listen to how Peter became what he is, which is a jack of many trades and master of most of them, and his delight at being able to direct this special production. Stay tuned. Here come the show.
Hearing from an inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice, with gentle prodding from the voice. Oh, you really can. Deeper, deeper down you dive, where the child's gone to survive, finding wisdom's other words. Oh, you really can. From nowhere, sitting in my own soft lap, with all the time for us to chat, and my resources, oh,
welcome to The Lynn Show. The Lynn Show is all about the little discussed fact, as I see it, that as children, we are hypersensitive to what it is that we do that brings a response we want, and what it is that we do that brings a response we don't want. And like the good little lab rats that we are, we learn to extinguish the responses that bring the unpleasant consequence. But extinguishing the response does not mean getting rid of the capacity. So if you were a voluble little boy or girl, and you talked very loud, and you had big gestures, and as a really tiny tot, you were really, really in your face and out there, and you understood very quickly, or as quickly as you possibly could, that that made somebody in your family really unhappy, and either got, some kind of criticism, or maybe a smack, or just you were ignored, and it didn't happen, it didn't it didn't get you anything. In fact, it got you something you didn't want. That you learned how to tone it down, and then you forgot that you had that capacity. As a psychotherapist, I have seen many clients who tell me that they never cry. Of course, this is impossible. It's a naturally occurring phenomenon, tears. But we can be taught not to do it. I have clients who say they never get angry. It doesn't matter what other people do, they never get angry. Well, how I understand that is that they were, it was made clear to them that these reactions were unacceptable. And because we are the most flexible beings on earth, I think, they learned first to pretend they didn't have it and then forgot they could. But perhaps you can see how important it would be to be able to cry, to be able to get angry when those emotions are appropriate. So many people come into therapy trying to do something that they actually can already do, but they forgot. And so much of the work of therapy is the first remembering, then the recovering, and then tolerating the consequences of that recovery, because the very good reason that you had for not doing it, it makes itself known when you begin to do it. And that's what the work of therapy is a lot about. So if you've been thinking about that, about going into therapy, about recovering a denied quality, or even just researching the possibility that there is a denied quality that you would like to have, and you'd like to talk to me about that, and you don't know yet that my entire private practice is on the telephone, and so I have clients all over the country and some other parts of the world. If you're curious about that, you can go to my website, thelynshow.com, thelynshow, and read the article called Psychotherapy on the Go, which I wrote about it, or click on Contact Me and ask me questions. But now I want to turn to my interview with Peter Amster, which is going to take up the rest of the show, because Peter has a lot to say, and he says it charmingly and wittily and interestingly. I am asking all of the directors who have directed for this season of the Oslo Repertory Theater to talk about not only their lives and how they became who they are, which is what I ask everybody about, but also about their philosophy of directing. And I have learned a great deal. And so perhaps there are things you don't know about directing, or things that you haven't heard from this particular director about his philosophy of directing and what he has learned that works on the stage in order to bring us the glorious work that he does. So here, without any more ado, Peter Amster. Okay, I am here with Peter Amster in the conference room of his lovely building. And I'm going to explain to Peter that I interview people who make their living or their life with an art. Oh, I didn't say that you're a director. And I only ask one question, and that is, where did it start? What gave you the idea that theater or stories or directing was of interest, was compelling, whatever?
Well, I have to confess that it didn't start as a director, of course. I started, like many directors did, as an actor. Mm-hmm. And I have to admit that it was in second grade. We were having an international luncheon, and each little class had to put on a little skit of some sort. And, of course, being a nice Jewish boy from Long Island, we got Saudi Arabia. We put on a little play called Jazim at the Oasis, and because I was a very voluble young man, they cast me as Jazim. It was a little play with a social crisis in it about whether to tell his dad the truth about coconuts or something. I can't remember exactly. But it all ended happily when he did the right thing. I guess that's the first time I was bit by that. I have to take it back. Back when I was 4 years old, my mom took me to see Mary Martin and Peter Pan on Broadway. And I thought, well, that's magic indeed.
Yes.
And being, of course, named Peter as well, I figured that, well, if she can fly, so can I. I had to be restrained from jumping out of second floor windows.
Is that the truth?
It's absolutely the truth.
I absolutely believe it. And the other thing that's so interesting about this is that you remember.
Oh,
you remember this at 4, you remember this at 7.
Absolutely.
You know, lots of people, if you ask them anything about their 4-year-old self or 7-year-old self, they wouldn't have it. But this is crystal in your mind,
well,
right?
Yes, and it's a kind of muscle memory because most of my recollections take the form of a kind of visceral kinesthetic sense rather than a picture in your head. I tend to be very, very physical. I think probably that had to do with the fact that my mom, I think she had her gallbladder out when she was 8 months pregnant with me, and she had been on so much morphine and Demerol and everything else for the pain. I was a drug baby, and I was very hyperactive, and I had very super hearing, and I was very, well, hypersensitive to things as well, and very hyperactive. But the thing that led me through, like a bullet through life at that age, was physicality, was kinetic and kinesthetic experience rather than visual or auditory.
I love
or
this.
Taste.
I love this expression, which led me through life like a bullet. I mean, it's so visceral. It really is.
It's true. And of course, even though I was interested in performing as an actor, my first thing was to study dance. I had been in school plays and all that, and I loved to sing, and I had taken piano lessons and all that.
Oh, so you have all of that stuff is going on in your childhood.
Absolutely.
Right.
I was very fortunate. It was back in those days. It was okay to get on the Long Island Railroad and take yourself at 11 and 12 years old into the city, and I went to the Met, I went to the Metropolitan Museum of Art, I went to Broadway shows, I went to off-Broadway shows.
Do you remember some of the early plays you saw?
I don't have larger memories of experience until the late 50s, early 60s.
Fiddler, so when are you in high school?
I'm not in high school until 64.
Okay, but so you start having these memories.
Oh,
right,
absolutely.
Right.
And really, starting in the late 50s, early 60s, I was going to the New York City Ballet and American Ballet Theater. And just, I mean, fell in love with Marcia Haydn and Eddie Bellella and all these great dancers. I mean, what they seemed to defy gravity. They were so gorgeous to look at, and I mean, I was such a kinetic, bouncy kid back then that I had to strap myself into my seat while watching them because my body was bouncing around to what I was watching on stage.
The other thing that occurs to me about this is that, and it's interesting because I think it's so smart, and clearly it was a reflex, that dance allows you to move around like this, but it gives you a structure. It contains the energy. It allows you the expression of the energy, but it doesn't get you into trouble.
No.
Do you know what I mean?
Exactly. It gives that virtual sense of force a structure.
Yes. If you didn't have that, that could have been very problematic for you.
Well, and I could have been also an athlete. When I got into high school, I was also on the track team. And I was also very fortunate to move to the Five Towns, which had a very progressive arts program. So there was a class called the Humanities. They took 15 kids and created this class, which started with the Greeks and dealt with all of the arts, going all the way forward to contemporary studying art criticism, philosophy, all of the visual and physical arts, and we would go on field trips to the various museums and with a really good docents, and also we went to the opening performance of Harold Pinter's The Homecoming.
Oh my God!
Yeah, it was we had people coming in to chat with the little class like Edward Villella, Jasper Johns, Leonard Bernstein. They came to our class.
Oh my God!
It was as great an education as anything can be imagined. So to George W. Hewlett High School, I say thank you for that.
Well, the other thing again that occurs to me is that this was not only sanctioned, right? You got the idea that this was you were allowed to think that this was a valuable thing to do with your life.
And a viable one.
And a viable one, exactly. And there were other kids who also had this point of view. You were not standing out being the only one. There was,
and the level of discussion about was really quite high-minded and very satisfying. However, I was also having pressure, like so many nice Jewish boys my age, to go into, you know, to become a doctor.
Of course.
And, of course, I was very good at science and math. Much more so than English and that. And so when I went to Northwestern, when I graduated, I went to, in the 6-year medical program. I had one of those wonderful Jewish mothers that grabbed by the ear and stared intently into your eyes and says, if anybody's going to cure cancer, darling, it's you.
I love that.
I wanted to do what I wanted to do, and so in the middle of, I think, sophomore year, I switched from to a theater major. Yeah, I'll have to hand that baton to somebody else to run with anyway. Mm-hmm. You know, I kept going back and forth to New York seeing shows and all that, and I decided, you know, you come to the crossroads, you have to decide what is it that you want to do with your life. I love the idea of research. That's probably what I would have done if I had stayed in medicine, because I was very interested in diagnostics and research and that kind of stuff. Anyway, backing up just a little bit, I went to a selected high school student program up at Potsdam, SUNY Potsdam, New York, that took high school kids from all over the state, and we took college courses, and I somehow applied and got into that, and met a girl that I liked, and she was studying with Iglevsky out in Massapequa Park, and I said, all right, I can do that, and so I started studying dance. I think I was a sophomore in high school. And that was, I felt liberated in a kind of way, that even in the stricture of classical dance, of ballet, that I was finding a kind of expressiveness. Well, it turned out that my body really wasn't able to do what I wanted it to. I've since had hip replacements, and the doctor says, what did you do back then? I said, no, you weren't. You couldn't be, because your hips have been malformed since birth. And so I realized what I was doing was mind over matter, trying to get my legs to do what they were supposed to do for ballet. Well, anyway, when I went to Northwestern and was even doing all my classes for medicine, I was also taking jazz and modern dance. So I kept going as a dancer, but I also switched into theater, and I started studying acting and all that, and I was a terrible actor.
Why?
I didn't know what the hell I was doing. I didn't understand the connection between the inner life of yourself and the inner life of a character. I didn't know how to be in the moment. When an actor is in the moment, they expand in there and they become larger in life. Their presence grows. Their aura grows. When they're in the group, you know, profoundly in the moment on stage, there are two things that pull an actor out of the moment. That pull you into the future if you don't know your lines and you're worrying about what comes next.
You're in your head.
Yes, or you're worrying about what the next beat is going to be or the next action is going to be. You get pulled into the past when you are critical of yourself in the moment and say, that sucked. Oh, that was good. That was bad. Nah, I could have done better. The critic that's on your shoulder saying you're good or bad is pulling you back into the past. You have to let go of the critic. You have to learn your lines and know what you're doing and be confident in what comes next and just be there. I didn't know how to do that. I was too much of a racer.
Yes.
Too impatient to be a good actor at the time.
Now, did somebody tell you this then and you simply couldn't do it, or you never understood it until
later?
No,
I kept doing it. I mean, I was good enough to get by at it, and since I was also a singer and a dancer...
Oh, right, you had all these...
I had all these other talents, and they right. say, well, he's triple threat, so he's not a great
actor. But okay,
but he can do this. He can do these other things, so there are certain roles that he could play that where that wouldn't make, you know, too much difference. So I got hooked on Gilbert and Sullivan.
In which you don't have to act very much.
Well, you do... No, you don't. You have to say, you have to hold your part.
That's right.
You have to learn a dialect. You have to sound convincingly British. And I had a good ear for RP, which is proper British pronunciation. And so I was one of the founding members of the Gilbert and Sullivan Guild at Northwestern, because it was just forming, and that's where I started. And I was also starting to choreograph. And I choreographed a few shows and was in a few shows at Northwestern. And then my senior year, the director of the Gilbert and Sullivan Guild said, do you want to direct? And I said, I don't know. Sure, why not? So he said, I want you to try the Mikado.
So you started out directing the Mikado?
First thing, 1970, I directed the Mikado, and of course I brought a choreographer sensibility to me. It was all
about... Yes, it was all about movement.
About movement, traffic patterns, and all
yes,
that.
Yes.
But I've always had a very good sense of humor. Most of that was developed as a kind of weapon against a very challenging family life.
Yes, right. Self-defense,
exactly. Armor. But also, I've been gifted in some kind of way of finding this life amusing.
Amusing. Very clever. Very, very clever.
I can't take complete credit for it, though I'd say I have cultivated that because I find it also a more pleasant way of moving through life.
Yeah. It's interesting because it seems to me that you have been presented with a number of challenges, and rather reflexively, not consciously or intellectually, you have found coping mechanisms that help you deal with the challenges in the most positive way. Do you understand what I'm saying?
I do. It was either that or succumb. I was just too...
Stubborn,
ebullient.
Yes, that's very different. That's very different. You were just too full of life.
I guess so. I mean, I think that's right.
I think that's right. It's just interesting. I mean, because it's not... So far, you haven't said, and you probably don't know, how come you made those choices.
Mm.
Because a lot of people would have descended into despair, gotten into a lot of trouble, you know, been obstructionist, difficult. I mean, there are a lot of ways that the obstacles that you had could have gone negatively, but they didn't.
Yeah. Well, one of the things I was very fortunate to do is I was going through a number of changes in my life, coming out and all that, at the same time dealing, as I said, with a difficult family life. My mother had remarried. My stepfather and I did not get along, and home was fairly much hell.
How old were you then?
That happened when I was 8, but by the time I finally said, my head's messed up. And Mom said, let's send you to a psychologist. I went, a therapist.
Mm-hmm.
And I told him, and he said, it couldn't possibly be as bad as all that. Let's work this through. I said, no, this is the way it is. And I said, tell you what, mister, you know, why don't you meet these people and tell me what you think? And I said, next session, it can be with them instead of me. And that's what they did. They both went into the next session with Dr. Grawler. No, Goldhill. Some wonderful man. And when I went back the next time, he said, you're right, they're Meshuggy. They're crazy. Get out of town as soon as you graduate. Find the farthest college you can go to.
Did he really? Good for him.
He did. And I must say, getting away from them and putting that into perspective,
yes,
of course.
Yes, right.
Being able to put that into perspective by getting some distance from it, really, that was the best therapy there was. And also not being under the thumb and inside the house where so much toxicity existed,
right,
was a marvelous thing.
Yes, oh my God. Well, good for him.
That was great.
So now you're off to Northwestern, and you've continued to dance, you've gone into... Gilbert and Sullivan, you've directed the Mikado.
Yes.
My God, it was a very busy and productive period of time for you.
It was fabulous. It was fabulous. I was very, very happy in undergraduate life, both in the medical part before I gave that
up. Right.
But in theater and extracurricular stuff and doing. Choreographing other shows as well, and then finally doing my own directing.
You found yourself, really.
Yeah, in a way I did.
Mm-hmm.
And also, my senior year, I met my life partner, Frank Galati, and...
Oh my God, you've been together that long.
41 years.
My goodness.
And so, I mean, my original plan probably was to move to New York like every other young triple threat / director, whatever.
Right.
But decided to stay in Chicago because we moved in together a few days before I graduated college at 20.
My goodness. Wow, lucky you.
Well, I guess so. I guess so.
I didn't mean to suggest everything is rosy and easy, but...
Oh, no, 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 no. As Stephen Sondheim once said, the best relationships are the most complicated.
Yes.
And it is a complicated one, but it is an extremely satisfying one. It's one, it's, you know, everybody always scratches their head and look at it and says, how can two directors carve out a life together without there being friction and static and all that? But we've managed to come to a place where we are so proud of each other and recognize each other's gifts. And we work totally differently.
I'm trying to interview all the people who are directing for the 2012 season at Oslo. And I want them to talk about their personal philosophy of directing, what you have to say about directing, and also something about Fallen Angels, because it's going to open soon. So could you talk about yourself as a director? Before you do that, you'd only... directed the Mercato, essentially.
Yeah.
So how did you come to identify yourself as a director?
Well, over the next 7 years after 1970, I was a professional actor, you know, basically a gypsy.
You did whatever you could do.
I did a lot of theater in Chicago. I did National Tour of 1776. I did a lot of theater as a performer, and also at the meantime, there was a new company, Chicago Opera Theater, that was just getting started, and I was choreographing and directing productions, and so was Frank at the same time. Così fan tutte, La Sia dell'Amore, I was starting to get into opera as well as operetta, and doing musicals, mostly, directing. I found that I really loved it, and since I could play piano, and I could sing well enough and be able to understand what a singer has to negotiate in order to create a role, and understood enough about acting to translate action from being a text-generated idea to being a musically-generated idea. I found that I was expanding into the role of an opera and musical theater director. At the same time, I was alternating that with acting and dancing and what have you. And then on the stage of the Candlelight Dinner Theater, during the hornpipe of Carousel, I busted my knee.
Oi.
Yeah. And that really was the end of the dancing part. I went through all the surgery and all that, but I realized that door was being closed with a thud. And in some way, it was a relief, because as joyous I was as a dancer, my technique sucked. And part of it has to do with the fact that I can't hold still long enough to concentrate.
That's right.
But part of it also had to do with the fact that my body still couldn't do what I really wanted it to.
Right, that's got to be so depressing.
Yeah. So as that was happening, and I had gone back for a master's, I decided after graduating with a B.S. in speech, which was a theater degree, to go back for my master's. Since Frank was also a professor and I got my bachelor's when he got his PhD from Northwestern in what was then the Oral Interpretation Department, has now become Performance Studies. Went back for my master's in Performance Studies, started really studying language, literature. Basically, performance studies was at that time defined as the study of literature through performance. What can we learn? It's like an English department filled with actors.
Wow.
It's really an interesting field of study, and opened up to me the world of fiction, of nonfiction, of poetry, and I started coming up with ideas of staging fiction and poetry as well. There was a great professor there named Robert Breen, who literally coined the term chamber theater and invented the technique of transforming literary texts in fiction and nonfiction to the stage, retaining a narrator and finding a way in which a narrator's efficacy on the stage can be manipulated in a kind of way and created in a satisfying way for telling a story. So I adapted and directed Eudora Welty, Flannery O'Connor, Thomas Mann, and stuff like that, and that was very exciting for me. Which kind of brought me in two directions. I already had a background in movement I had a background in music. I'd studied piano for 15 years. And now I was, that last thing in terms of becoming a theater director rather than an opera director was coming into play.
Yeah, text.
Yes, text.
Mm-hmm. God, you had all the pieces.
Yeah, so I started probably in the early 80s starting to direct plays. I was very fortunate also to have a dear friend who was, well, Frank's friend first and then mine, Libby Apple, who was was a director at the Goodman, worked on her master's in Northwestern, and she was teaching at the Goodman, then became the artistic director of Indiana Repertory Theater, and then from there moved on to the 10 years as artistic director at the Oregon Shakespeare Festival, the largest theater company in the United States, except for Lincoln Center, and she saw in me what other people, everybody saw in me either Frank's little friend or the dancer who thinks he can direct. There were a number of challenges in terms of my image in Chicago. Libby saw through that. She said, no, I want you to direct. And she brought me to all of her theaters, and I followed her around the country, expanding the repertoire of things I directed from children, theater for young audiences into more interesting and complicated things to Abe Lincoln in Illinois, State of the Union, anyway, and then finally, when I got to Oregon, to Noel Coward,
mm-hmm.
Shakespeare, etc., and I am forever in her debt for her belief in me.
Yeah, I hear a lot in these interviews the serendipity of someone
mm-hmm.
seeing, believing, being there at the right time.
Yeah.
You know,
it's interesting. I'm going to go back to college just for a second to tell a little story. I was doing a scene in an acting class, it was a scene from The Great White Hope, and I was playing the Mexican fight trainer or something like that. I couldn't remember. And I was not doing well. And there was this wonderful actress who was happened to be in the class as well. Her name was Evelyn Barron. I think she's the artistic director of a theater on the East Coast now, nobody was actually teaching acting. I mean, it's a very hard thing to teach.
Yes.
I mean, you can teach technique and all that, and there's Meisner approach, and there's Stanislavski approach, but nobody was doing that in the mid-60s at Northwestern. And she sat me down and told me a little bit about what it is to be an actor and what you need to do, and to forget about doing that, and forget about doing that. And basically what she was saying is, get your choreographer hat off of your head. Get your directors, get your audience members' hat off of your head. Be there in the moment. All you got to do is say the lines and don't bump into the furniture. Simplify.
Yeah.
Focus. And I went on stage and everybody went, ooh. So, you know, there are these angels that show up in your life at the right moment to give you a lesson that profoundly, you know, that you veer, you shift or swerve from one focus to the other, and it, all of a sudden everything clicks into focus and you can move
forward.
Yeah,
and it's also, I think, a little bit when the student is ready. You know, you were able to hear that then and use it.
Yeah.
Right? Right. Okay, so then later we have Libby Apple doing the same thing.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly. And just giving me the opportunity and the confidence to expand and develop my craft as a director. One of the things I found out, I mean, after watching Okado and a few of the earlier things that I directed, is that I started to get disappointed in what I was looking at, and I realized that it's because everybody looks like me. Something's wrong here. And I realized that, starting as a choreographer, that kind of micromanaging movement and all that was not the right way to go. It all looked pretty. The stage pictures were pretty, but there was something missing at the heart.
Mm-hmm.
And so I realized I had to develop a grammar of discourse with actors that gave them the agency, gave them the sense that they're making this up as it's happening. That,
mm-hmm.
that allows them to that validates their choices rather than simply imposes mine. So that has been my process. It's an ongoing one.
That's your journey.
Yeah.
It's interesting because, you know, there are directors who believe that it's all about the physicality,
mm-hmm.
and if they get the actors to move in the right way, that it'll be okay.
But the right way is, you know, if the right way is imposed simply from the outside, it's not going to look good.
I agree.
However, I also think on the other thing, I see some shows where the philosophy of directing is never to give them blocking, never, you know, it all has to come from the actors.
Right.
And it becomes a kind of shapeless mass.
Yes.
It doesn't have the architecture isn't.
There's no structure.
Yeah, exactly. Something about the architecture of a production, of a performance, that's every bit as satisfying and as important as the inner light and the beating heart that drives through it. And so getting that balance right is part of what I feel I have to do and provide for the production as well as for the actors.
That's great. So you want to talk a little bit about Fallen Angels?
Well, dear Michael Donald Edwards, you know, I said, what do you want to do next year, darling? After Death Trap, I said, well, and he mentioned Fallen Angels, and I didn't know it, and I knew all things Coward. I had adapted a short story called Ashes of Roses with Noel Coward and put music to it, and it was a big success in Chicago. I think he saw my production of A Present Laughter at the Oregon Shakespeare Festival. When Libby Apple retired as artistic director at the Oregon Shakespeare Festival, I had been working every year, except for 7 years, during her tenure there. When the new artistic director came in with a very different vision for the theater and his own people from the West Coast, I realized, well, that's the end of this journey, and that's fine. I had 7 wonderful years working at the Oregon Shakespeare Festival, but at that same time, Michael had just become artistic director here at the Oslo Rep, and he asked me to direct, and I said, sure. That's one of the reasons I moved from Miami to Sarasota, was that here is a place where I think I might be able to actually have a job in the same place where I live.
Yes.
And as you know, and most people do, that Miami is a vast wasteland when it comes to theater.
Yes.
It has the ballet, it has the symphony, the World Symphony, but I moved to Coconut Grove just months before the chain link fence went up around the Coconut Grove Playhouse. And there's a couple of smaller venues, but no place that, to be perfectly honest, can afford me. There's a lot of theater being brought into the Arts Center and to other places, big touring companies.
Yeah, right.
But in terms of an indigenous regional theater in Miami, it does not exist.
Well, you know, maybe this isn't true, but maybe there isn't an audience for it.
Well, the audience that came down from the Northeast is either dying out or moving out of Miami-Dade County, and the expanding and burgeoning Latino population aren't theatergoers in the same kind of way.
No, that's right.
And I do know that a number of theaters down there who have tried to change their programming to include Spanish-speaking have not been successful.
Yeah.
At least not yet. It's everything is evolving down there. But I've been told recently, and I'm not sure if this is true, but it felt like it, that now Miami is 65% Spanish speaking.
Oh yeah, there's no question. It's going on the way.
It's America's foreign city.
That's right.
And that's one of the things I loved about it.
Yeah.
I mean, it was so exotic and interesting and all.
But you
that.
Don't get theater there.
But I had to leave town in order to go to work.
Right. Right.
So one of the reasons I moved here, and I thought, well, even if I don't work here every year at the Oslo, that Sarasota affords me the opportunity, if not at the Oslo, then at Florida Studio Theater. Well, and also not only just to work in the theater, but to go to theater.
I was going to say, you're surrounded by the theater here.
By the theater, by the ballet, by dance, by opera, by the symphony.
That's right.
I hope everybody out there realizes that this doesn't happen anywhere else.
No.
This is a unique arts environment in the United States. I think Michael said there are more people working in the arts per capita in Sarasota than any other place in the United States except New York.
I didn't know that.
Yes.
Yes, I love that. I just love it. And this is a community
in a way
that New York is a community and L.A. is not a community.
Exactly.
You know.
There's a center.
There's a center. Yeah, that's right.
There's a center of gravity and ethos of the place that comes together. I go to a restaurant and see board members and other actors and dancers that I've admired and artistic directors and all that. And everybody's talking to each other.
Yeah.
There's cross-pollination between the arts and within the art, you know, each of the arts that I find very exciting.
So Michael said Fallen Angels.
Fallen Angels. And I said, what? And I went and read it, and I thought it was a hoot. This is a hidden, a missing treasure, actually, because according to what Michael says, it had been pulled by a producer in England from professional productions, because he wanted to mount it in the West End. And he sat on it and sat on it and sat on it, and finally I think he went broke or something and had to relinquish the rights this year.
Wow.
So the time has arrived to bring back The Fallen Angels. It's very early Coward. I think it's one of his second hit after The Vortex. It doesn't have the same kind of depth, grandeur, and polish of Private Lives, but it is a very funny and very poignant in a kind of way play. Hilarious because it's about two women, best friends, both married for five years, and the first bloom of passion is off their marriages, and they get postcards from Maurice Duclos, a man that both of them, not at the same time, however, had affairs with before they were married. And he's coming back to London, and they're hysterical because they don't know what is it going to look like. Has he aged? Has he grown a mustache? There's all that, but also, can our marriage survive? You know, do we want this kind of passion again? And as they're talking about that, they're getting rip-roaring drunk. And so not only their marriages and their sanity's foundation is at risk, but
their friendship
is. Right. And so it's very funny stuff.
But it brings in all of the possible complications in relationships.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I'm sure there's a few listeners out there who would admit to themselves, if not to others, that they've had a moment where their relationship, their marriage is on a very even keel, going along very nicely, and then somebody or something from the past comes knocking on the door, and you go, oh my God, him or her. How do I feel about that?
And what do I do?
And what do I do? Do I see them? Do I keep my composure? I mean, if I find them as wildly attractive and sexy as I did once, do I flee? I mean, the girls, they both pack bags. They're going to run. they're getting their passport visa, and they're going to go to America.
Right.
They're getting as far away as they can, but they decide to stay and be adults about it and get schnockered.
Oh, that's wonderful. Are you using any music?
Oh, yes. There's a song which I didn't know.
Oh, it's not If Love Were All.
Huh? No, it's not. Well, that might creep into...
Oh, my God. That's
there's a piano on stage, a requisite for a Noel Coward play. And it turns out that quite a few of the people, including the maid, are musical. In fact, the maid is one of the best characters. Her name is Jasmine, but since the husband has trouble with names, they call her Saunders. And the divine Carolyn Michael is playing this role, and of course she seems to be an expert in everything.
She is.
And while the house is empty, she sits down at the piano and plays something and sings a little bit and then gets interrupted. But there's a song called Même les anges. Even the angels succumb to love.
Oh.
I hadn't been able to find it. In fact, I'm still in the process. I found it online. It turned out that Farber Music in London
published it.
Has it. So I bought it. It came to me. It's in manuscript form. It's not even published. And it didn't even have all the words written into it. And says Même les anges or the song from Fallen Angels by Noel Coward.
It's actually from Fallen Angels.
Yes. Yes.
Jesus.
And it's used as a kind of leitmotif through it. So I sit down and I start to play it, and I said, well, it sounds vaguely like Coward, but there are a few elements missing. I don't even know if this song is the original song yet. So just even last night at midnight, I wrote to the Noel Coward estate saying, is this the right song? Because there's no B section. I've done enough Noel Coward, plus reviews and all that, to know that he writes ABA.
Right.
He doesn't write A.
Right.
And that's all this song is. And there's no...
There's no bridge.
There's no bridge. There's no melodic...
shift.
Inventiveness, really.
Really?
It's okay. It's fine. I think it's important that it's a French song, because it's a song that he would... You know, and he didn't speak any English back then.
Oh, I see.
And they're wondering, do you think he'll have learned English?
The other ones see. Never
oh, I hope not. His French was so beautiful. So there is that music in it, and there might be a few other tunes. tunes. We're still in the process of culling. And one more thing I do want to say about it,
right,
and that particularly about the Ocelot and doing it here, is one of the great joys. Of course, Fallen Angels, it's a one-set drawing room comedy of manners, which give actors a chance to be to show that they're supreme farceurs and supreme comedians and clowns, as well as good actors. And to be gifted with the Ocelot, which brings the best of the best, the cream of the crop together, it's one of the more delicious sandboxes to play in. Believe me. The quality, the level of production, the scenery, this one of the best costume shops in the country, bar none. And to work with all these phenomenal actors, it makes all of us feel very giddy and joyous going to that rehearsal every day.
Okay, so let me see. I like to ask if there's anything I didn't ask that I should have, and also, really, having given a life to not only the art of theater, but the art of all the arts that you have, you know, is there anything that you want to say in retrospect about what that's like?
Yeah, it's a gift to be proficient enough in any of these things is a gift. To be able to speak the language of music and dance and theater and all that, and I've only done that because I've been curious about them and had a facility for them, but to be able to integrate them and to be able to develop not ways of appreciating all the arts and also ways of conversing about them, so I can talk to opera singers in terms of what the music means in terms of the inner drama. What does the modulation into A major mean over here? You know, for this character, things like that. It's very satisfying.
Yes,
it's very satisfying, and it gives me enormous pleasure to be in a room with artists, first of all, because I admire them. And I think, as you were saying about the earlier about the process for me, when I discovered, as I was talking before, about being disappointed in the work that was basically choreographed rather than directed, and then having to develop a grammar of discourse with actors that allowed that, giving them agency, and realizing that there are many different processes for an actor, as there are actors. There are those who have to sit and think and, you know, hold their head in their hands and cogitate before they take one step forward. They have to process. And then
they're seat of the pants guy.
And then there's a person who jumps in with both feet into the sandbox and says, "How am I doing?"
Yeah, right.
and you have to validate every process, and you have to find a way of talking to each of these actors, and you have to make them both
work together
and feel like and appreciate. Most actors that I work with appreciate other actors and appreciate the differences in the process. Every once in a while, there's somebody who's a very, very quick study, who makes decisions fast, who might get a little impatient with some of the slower ones, who take a little more time to get to those decisions, those beats.
And that is one of the ways in which a director can really be useful.
Right.
Right. To help, I wanted to say modulate that, I don't know what the word is, but
yeah,
right.
It's close. It's moderate.
Moderate. Thank
there you.
Go.
But I think the important thing of my job also is to make, I mean, what we're doing, there's a profound reason they're called plays.
Mm-hmm.
And that what happens in the rehearsal hall and what eventually you see on stage has to feel playful.
Yes.
That the whole process is of embodying character, performing. It doesn't matter if it's comedy or tragedy, but that playfulness needs to be part
joy.
Of it. Yeah. It has to be infectious in a kind of way that invites an audience to have an aesthetic response.
Yes.
And an aesthetic response, of course, is perceptual, it's memory, it's adjudication, it's all those various different ways, different structures of consciousness. But there's got to be this relinquishing of the sense that this isn't real. That this, you know, it's put on, it's sham, it's artifice. And just positing, and just bracketing that for a side and saying, well, what if it was real? And surrendering to the story that's unfolding in front of you. And that irresistibility, I think, is very much connected to the playfulness that's created in the rehearsal hall.
Yes, and to the skill of the actors and the director.
Right.
This is lovely. Thank you so much, Peter.
When you hear Peter Amster talk about what he's trying to create on stage for us, the experience that he's trying to create for us, you hear not only the many, many skills that he's been able to accumulate over his lifetime, but the passion, the dedication, the intensity of his involvement in this work. And you know that the boy who saw magic in Peter Pan, and the youngster who got to be Jazim on stage, is still there. He fell in love with this art right away, immediately, upon observing it and having any taste of it. But the other really significant thing I think about Peter is that he continued to evolve his interest, his commitment, his connection. That's actually the word I want. His love, his desire, his passion for dance. But it was not enough. His interest in acting, in being on stage, on performing, but again, not quite enough. And so instead of being disappointed, instead of being bitter, instead of turning his back on this, he continued to evolve, emerge, accumulate, until he found the work that combined everything for him, and that is so clearly the work of his life, directing, in which he gets to put all of those pieces together. Now, of course, not everybody is smart enough or flexible enough to continue to evolve in the face of, well, I don't know, I wasn't so good at that, or now I see that I could do this better, or this could be done better than I'm doing it. That's a remarkable capacity that Peter has, and I'm sure that is what makes him not only the director that he is, how competent and skilled, but also somebody that people want to work with. And the message that I'm hoping that you take away from this interview is that having arrived at an idea about who you are, don't settle if it doesn't feel right. There may definitely be more of you, more to you, than you have previously noticed, observed, or demonstrated. And I'm not talking only here about skills. As you know, if you've been listening to the show, I'm talking about qualities of being. Have you come into this world as a shy person, but do you have an assertive person inside, you know? And of course, I could go on and on with these, and we don't have a lot of time, so I'm not going to. But that's the message that Peter's interview so dramatically presents, that what you see may not be all that there is. Don't be disappointed. Don't be bitter. Look and see if there's somebody else in there. And of course, as I quite often say, as a caution, submerged qualities, when they reemerge, can cause some difficulty. And so you need to be alert to that fact. Okay, so As always, I have to thank Josh Hackney, who rushes down here at a moment's notice to help me, fix me, save me, show me, do for me. And this is all related to the show, the sound, the recording, the editing, the uploading, the computer, working in websites that I'm unfamiliar with. And if you need any of that help, then you definitely want Josh Hackney, and you can get him, and you can get me by going up on my website, thelynshow.com, thelynneshow.com, thelynshow.com. Click on Contact Me and ask me for Josh, ask me about therapy on the phone, ask about the book. Tell me something that you want to say about the show. And if you have downloaded the show and you want to, please write a review. Or if you use the social media, Facebook, LinkedIn, Twitter, we're on all of them, and you like anything you've heard, please do think to say it on one of those sites. And of course, as always, as I just got finished saying, I hope you got something you can use from this show. Something that you didn't know, and I learned some things in the show that I didn't know. Maybe you knew them already, but maybe there were other things that stimulated you in some important way. Anyway, something that'll bring you back, because I will be here next week, same time, same station, and I sure hope you will be too.
See, I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Oh, you say my face and figure have both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring. I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a that I have had my shot. My time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage, let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a bell I keep on ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly. Well, I don't give a dang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Rising from the ashes every chance I get. I may be running out of time, but it ain't over yet. 'Cause me and Sister Phoenix, we won't give up the flight. No, no, we will not go gentle into that good night. And I won't go with a whimper. On singing, not a tune that I once sang. I may not be as juicy, hell, but I still got some tang. So you won't hear me simper. I may have gotten